Hello, good morning, everybody. I'd like to express my appreciation to Twain and the organizing committee for putting this symposium together and the opportunity to visit with you today. As the title would indicate, this is going to be the talk that kind of sets the stage for the talks that follow. So if you are a data-intensive sort of person, you're going to be very disappointed with this talk. Because it is conceptually dense, but not very data dense. The approach is going to be more of the 35,000-foot sort of approach. The focus is to address the issues that are really the topic of the symposium, challenges, opportunities, and application. So to begin, it's probably appropriate to start a conversation about grazing research by addressing the issue of why grazing experiments. And so I've listed a number of issues here. Jerry Matches, in a nice paper in 1992, suggested that the effects of herbivory could not be simulated by clipping. There are a lot of other experiments that have provided other reasons for doing grazing research, provide animal-based comparisons, supply guidelines for practical grazing management. May also be interested in some of the basic information on the biology of these systems, and we may be interested in defining input-output relationships, which are very difficult to do outside the pasture. I hesitate to mention any successes because there are so many, and so you select a very limited some set, but I've just identified a couple of here. In terms of successes of grazing management research, Joe Boughton's group developing alfalfa cultivars in Georgia, and just recently we've released a couple of limpograsses in Florida that were developed as a function of grazing research. So that's a very brief introduction, and I'd like to move now into the first of these three main topics of conversation, challenges, opportunities, and application, by talking about challenges. Sometimes I think grazing researchers can be a bit whiny because we like to talk about how nobody likes to fund grazing research, and we go on and on and on. But there are some challenges, and so I'm going to start by, at the risk of whining, I'm going to start by reviewing a few of these. First thing I'm going to talk about are some obstacles to meaningful scale. And that terminology may or may not be obvious to you to begin with, but I think it will become more obvious as we move along. So some of those obstacles are the simple resource requirements that are required to conduct grazing research, the limited inputs in terms of funds, short funding cycles that we're all aware of in terms of grant funding. Within that context, though, grazing researchers still have to perform according to the same metrics as other scientists, and publication, and particularly quantity of publication, is a major metric for professional advancement. And also a significant metric for some institutions is throughput of graduate students, so longer-term research may not be very attractive within that context. Together, or in some cases individually, those obstacles weigh against both long-term research and large-scale experiments. And so then, as grazing scientists, we're sometimes then forced to deal with compromising among a number of issues, including kind of knowing and understanding what an optimal time and spatial scale might be, but not sure we can achieve it because of lack of funding availability, and also the need to achieve benchmarks for professional advancement that may be difficult with long scale type experiments. So I'm going to talk about scaling in two ways. One, talking about time, and then secondly, on a spatial basis. Time scales are very important for a number of reasons, and I've just identified two of them here. Clearly, there are environment by treatment interactions, and very difficult to detect that interaction when you only do an experiment for 1 year. So multiple years to experience or to impose treatments in different environments is important for understanding the nature of that interaction. A second important issue is that there are cumulative effects of management treatments on pastures. So what happens in year three is not simply a function of the environment in year three, but it's also a function of the fact that treatment was imposed in year one and year two. And by the way, producers typically aren't working on single year cycles. In looking at some literature, we made this assessment that or a judgment, the two-year assessments even are often insufficient to predict long-term responses to grazing management. And just to give you an example of that, and I could find many, but we did a comparison of two perennial peanut, rhizoma peanut cultivars, Arbrook, which is a more upright growing type, Flora Graze, more decumbent. We looked at them under continuous stocking over a few years to compare plant and animal responses. So during the first 2 years under continuous stocking, there was no difference in terms of the contribution of rhizoma peanut on a percentage of the herbage mass basis in these pastures. But by year three, the more upright growing type began to suffer under continuous stocking. In terms of animal performance, likewise, no difference in the first 2 years. We go to year three, the differences associated with the contribution of the peanut are now also showing up in terms of animal response. So for making recommendations, the recommendation depends on the length of the experiment. And I don't know about you, but if I'm making recommendations to producers, that makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. So if providing meaningful results is what we're all about, short-term research can, in some cases, be counterproductive and lessen overall research impacts. All right, moving from time scales to spatial scales, as forage scientists, we find creative ways to minimize space. And we may use space planting instead of swards, clip versus grazed, and small plots for enclosures versus large pastures, and so on. There are some problems or potential problems associated with failure to scale spatially. The treatments as we impose them may not be relevant at all to production circumstances. We may not achieve the level of statistical rigor that we aspire to. We may actually cause or affect animal behavior. So that what goes on in terms of how animals interact with the pasture under our small spatial scale may be very different than what we're really attempting to look at under production scale. And we may be unable to achieve meaningful economic comparisons. All right, so that was the first of those challenges that we're going to look at. We'll move through some of these others more quickly. Another is one that we do complain about quite a bit, and that is those are issues related to funding and personnel. Dr. Katz, who you'll hear from in just a little bit, did several surveys over the period from 1984 to 2008, and during that time period observed a 60% reduction in research FTEs in the forage livestock area in the southeastern region, and a 36% reduction in teaching FTEs. Here are the numbers that are associated with that. And in the 2008 version of that survey, then respondents were actually asked to estimate 2013. So that's where those numbers come from. So clearly there's some issues in terms of the numbers of people that are now doing grazing research. There's also been a reduction in support. State support has decreased. For those of you who have gray hair like I do, you know, you remember the 1980s, right? And during that time period in the 1990s, there was much greater level of state support. By 2008, primarily, those funds were grant related. So Monty and his colleagues suggested that in order for forage utilization research to continue, we're going to need to identify some fundable themes. And we'll talk about those fundable themes in a bit. There's also the issue in terms of challenge, in terms of relevance. And communicating relevance can be particularly challenging. And from the grazing research perspective, we occupy a somewhat uncomfortable fence straddling position in that we are trying to kind of bridge that gap between fundamental and applied science. So like the purely fundamental researcher, we need to be concerned about discovery. We're interested in learning new things. And we're interested in scientific outputs for professional advancement. Like the purely applied scientist, our impacts are evaluated also based on development of technologies and products that are adopted by end users. So I've experienced this, and maybe some of the rest of you have, that we can simultaneously be dismissed as unsophisticated and irrelevant by fundamental scientists and impractical and ivory tower types by end users. I would argue that executing a research program that achieves both scientific discovery and technology is both extremely challenging and a worthy goal, and one to which we should aspire. There is also, in terms of this relevance issue, there's some tension between the fundamental and applied areas in terms of choice of research themes and approaches. So should we be mechanistic and be focusing on tiller dynamics, for example? Or should we be evaluating the fitness of potential technologies or products? Should we be working in a controlled on-station environment to ensure publication and repeatable data? Or, as John was talking about just a few minutes ago, should we be on-farm dealing with some of those issues that may increase the likelihood of adoption? Should methods and treatments be rigid, repeatable, so that in our materials and methods we can say we did the same thing year after year? Or should they be adaptive, like many producers who are responding to real-world situations? I didn't mention early on, but I'm going to ask more questions than I'm going to answer in this subject, and I'm counting on my colleagues who followed to answer all of them, and I'm sure they will. Another issue is the issue of knowledge gaps in terms of a challenge. If we're decreasing availability of funds and scientists, then prioritization is particularly important within that context. Those priorities are dictated based on the conditions locally that you're working with, but they also should be decided upon within the context of an awareness of the literature and where the gaps are in that literature. There have been a number of recent papers that have addressed this issue in terms of identifying research priorities and knowledge gaps within forage livestock research and grazing research, and those are listed. Paper that we did a number of years ago, kind of addressing this issue a bit, we said that the value of grazing studies may be enhanced, and a couple of ways we can do that is by greater attention to some procedural shortcomings that have hindered and handicapped grazing research over the years, and also perhaps by expanding our horizons to assess responses beyond the traditional plant and animal measurements. Some specific examples that were given, and this is by no means comprehensive, this is just a few. Perhaps it would be very valuable to identify thresholds of grazing intensity, stocking rate, sward height, above which substantial environmental impacts can occur. Perhaps it would be of great interest to address the effect of management practices on wildlife, habitat, nesting success, species diversity, number of issues. And perhaps it would be of significant interest to look at utilization of legumes and the effect of legume proportion on carbon footprint of grassland systems and the ability to ameliorate greenhouse gas and carbon and climate change issues. All right, so that's a kind of an overview of some of the challenges that we're dealing. I want to now move on to some opportunities. And I'm just going to address these three main categories of subjects. And again, this could go on for a long time, but we'll try to focus on a limited subset. Those of us who work in grasslands, we feel like we have a very good story to tell in terms of ecosystem services of grasslands. And I take every opportunity to tell those stories. Ask my kids, they would know. They, you know, tick them off. We know all about that, Dad. However, in the interest of full disclosure, there's another side to that story. There are issues in terms of greenhouse gas emissions by livestock, overgrazing associated with grassland degradation can have significant negative environmental impacts. So clearly there's, you know, a plus side and negative side to some of the ways in which forage livestock systems interact with the broader ecosystem. In terms of focusing this relative to opportunities, I would suggest that the broader awareness of the role of grasslands and how we manage them actually presents us with some opportunities, because I think it's increased the appreciation of the importance of grasslands and grassland research. Clearly, over the time span of my career, that's true. It's also created some alternative funding streams. So getting at Monty's comment about fundable themes, there may be some additional funding themes associated with this transition. And also it's increased the importance, clearly, in my mind, of multidisciplinary teams. So going forward, I think achieving a wider range of objectives in grazing research, other than some of the things that we traditionally did and did perhaps when I first started in this game, would be very exciting and very important. I mentioned or alluded to this issue of multidisciplinary teams, and I think this is really an exciting opportunity for those of us who've done grazing research. I think most opportunities in that area of fundable themes going forward are going to require much broader discipline interaction than what I would relate to from the first half of my career, for example. So those who understand greenhouse gases, soil carbon, you pick your area, but these would be important folks to integrate into our research program, both from the perspective of us integrating them, but then also them integrating us and providing some opportunities to address topics that perhaps we would not have felt comfortable leading a grant to address. Now, John also alluded to this issue of on-farm research, which it can be an opportunity, depending on how you perceive it and approach it. But if we are dealing with spatial and time constraints and time limitations, one approach to that is to look to on-farm research. I would just suggest that this is by no means a casual undertaking. I've actually done more on-farm research in this last year of my career than I've done in any year of my program up to this point. And I would just say that the challenges of doing on-farm research should not be underestimated. I was not courageous enough to try to do grazing research on-farm, but even establishment and some other kinds of more simple types of approaches can be very challenging within the on-farm context. A couple of things that we found, I think, is that producer engagement is particularly critical. And then also, don't overestimate the ability of the farmer to understand what you have in mind in terms of the research. Very detailed protocols and engagement with the producer in terms of incorporating those protocols is important. I'd like to have time to tell you a story here, but unfortunately I don't, so I'll resist the urge to do that. But even in the best cases, I think clearly on-farm research has much greater risk, and personally I've never been brave enough to do graduate student research on-farm. Another opportunity for grazing researchers is this theme of new technologies, and I think as I think back over the years of my career, I'm still doing a lot of measurements the same way I did when I started. And, that's a little discouraging. So I'm really pleased to say that there are some technologies now being developed that give us some opportunities and have some implications for the future. Some of those were discussed here in the graduate competition yesterday. But there are lasers and sensors for herbage mass and chemical composition of grazed swards. And I think Rob may allude to a couple of these in just a bit. Just looking at that area, I think those developments may actually have some impact in terms of giving us ability to measure some variables that have been challenging in the past and increase our ability to establish causal relationships. The last area then that I want to talk about is application. And this is simply a Solinberger definition of application, but it's defined in terms of use or adoption by clientele, and those clientele may be scientific or producer clientele, and achieving real world impacts. There are some barriers to that goal of application. In some cases, our fundamental biology doesn't translate very well to producer need. Sometimes the things that we do at a research center don't translate very well to farm. And sometimes our focus on production doesn't translate very well to the broader functionality of agroecosystems. So are these real or false dichotomies? I'm going to actually give my answer for that one, and I say I think they can actually be false dichotomies, because I think with creativity, we can answer fundamental questions while developing technology and products for producers. I think we can capitalize on the strength of research center work and incorporate high-risk activities on farm as part of the program. And I think we can design research that answers those traditional production questions, but expands to address issues within the broader ecosystem context. Okay, as part of application, I think we need a seat at the table, and that may not be intuitively obvious what I'm talking about, but I think greater appreciation and application of our science occurs when we are interacting directly with our scientific colleagues and with our end users. So I'm going to ask just a number of questions relative to this issue. I would just ask, are we sufficiently demanding within our own community of grazing researchers of scientific excellence so that we engender respect among our scientific, more fundamental scientific colleagues? It's one thing to whine about it. It's another thing to say, okay, let's do something about it. Let's, you know, ratchet up. Let's get our act together and do a better job of fundamental science to increase the level of respect that we have within the broader scientific community. Are we sufficiently engaged with producer and societal needs that were of any use to producers and to addressing real-world questions? I would suggest that we can't simply be the good old boy, good old girl. I'm working cattle, growing grass, and talking over the fence, you know. I think we need to be mechanistic. I think we need to be discovering new knowledge. That's part of what we're supposed to be doing. And we can't simply be fundamental biologists because we need that translation to adoption. Publication for us is not the end of the story. The last theme that I want to talk about in terms of application is communicating outputs. So the question is, are we effectively communicating those outputs to the target clientele leading to adoption and impact? One thing we need to think about a bit is, do we believe that we have a stake in adoption or only in development? What is our role? Max Shelton from Australia talked about champions for various products or technologies. Are we interested or willing to do that? Going forward, I think we need to integrate the fact that there are going to be fewer of us. And within that context, as we look at communication, do we need to more critically define the target audience and ensure we reach them? One thing that I think we can do is we can push greater effort at producers who are change agents, and so be less involved in terms of talking about our technology with the total of the production audience and focus that conversation. And then greater hands-on attention in those on-farm demonstrations to ensure adoption and implementation. Okay, we'll wrap up then with just a few summary comments and conclusions. I've tried to give you an idea that grazing experiments provide numerous benefits and that they are well documented. That there are significant challenges to the future of grazing research. That we need to think about fundable themes because most of our work that would target applied technology and product is not going to be attractive to funding agencies. I think that clearly there's increasing attention to ecosystem services and interaction of forage livestock systems with the environment. These take us well beyond our traditional measures of plant and animal responses. They also provide us some opportunities to engage the broader scientific community and increase participation of non-traditional collaborators. I think we need to think about how effective we are in communicating our outputs. Is communication leading to adoption and impact? And perhaps that's how we should evaluate our communication. Do we as scientists, and particularly from a research perspective, have a role in technology or product adoption, or are we simply developers of technology? I would say the jury is still out in terms of the future of grazing research. I would like to add one little positive spin to that. This shows the number of journal articles reporting grazing research that has been published in the Tri-Society journals over the last 30 years, and you can see a very pronounced trend. So there's still, I think, in my mind, opportunities emerging in grazing research for some of us who can incorporate collaborators representing a broader range of disciplines and effectively develop and communicate our outputs to clientele. Just one final word. I have to attribute these thoughts to one of my colleagues, Jean Vendramini. He suggested that forage livestock research may provide limited IDC generation to the university or the experiment station. However, the very noticeable impacts on clientele and resultant advocacy of those clientele for our science may more than compensate for the lack of IDC. And perhaps just a word of admonition to any administrators or inspiring administrators in our group: undervaluing providing products to traditional clientele when filling positions or establishing programmatic direction may undermine public support for the entire experiment station model. Thank you very much. Plain says I have time for a couple of questions. Jim. Okay, so Jim's question was relative to the balance or to the relative merits of proactive and reactive research. And I won't venture a rating in terms of ranking their value. I would simply say that we've done such research in the Florida context where we anticipated increasing pasture-based dairy industry, for example. And we were able to fund that research because it was a fundable theme. It linked to fundable themes. We were able to develop a lot of data, but we were well ahead of the producer interest in that. And it was only subsequent years down the road where, you know, some of their questions arose that we were able to go back 10 years and say, this is what we found. So that's an example of perhaps a proactive, but there's also then the need for reactive research to be perceived as being responsive to immediate needs and immediate concerns. So I think in terms of an overall research portfolio, to the extent that you can balance that portfolio between some forward thinking and some reactionary thinking, I think that's probably the safest position to be anyway.
I want to cut you off.
All right. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Lynn.